Welcome to Fate's Wide Wheel, a Quantum Leap podcast with Sam and Dennis. We are coming to you from our top secret headquarters at Project Quantum Leap, but you can find us online at fwwquantumleappod.com or follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Fate's Wide Wheel. And please do us a favor by hitting the subscribe button on iTunes. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Fate's Wide Wheel, and happy 2018. Spoiler alert, we're actually recording this in December of 2017.
Hopefully we made it to 2018.
Oh boy, what a world.
We will see. Anyway, yeah. Welcome to 2018 for all intents and purposes.
Absolutely, and we are just very excited to be back. I think that taking a couple of weeks off was going to be a good idea. Mm-hmm. Celebrate the holidays.
Exactly.
Do you have family coming in for?
I do not. Well, yes, actually, that's not true. Jess's youngest sister will be here. So shout out to Haley because she'll probably be listening. And she's going to stay with us for a few days before going down to Indianapolis, and then we're all going to travel down there because that's where Jess's family lives.
Awesome.
Her parents live anyway.
Awesome.
I'm busy right now, but you know, with work, I get it. Doesn't matter. I could say where I work. I don't think my bosses would care or anything like that. But mm-hmm. I in addition to the acting stuff, I also work at the Joffrey Ballet, and it's Nutcracker season, which is a crazy time of year for us. A lot of late nights and working over at the ballet company. But it's been fun. It's been good, and it'll be nice to take that break and you know enjoy the holidays and that sort of thing. What about you?
Wife's family, mom, sister are coming into town for Christmas Eve and Christmas Day.
Nice.
That's about it.
Nice.
Otherwise, this is our first year with our newborn son.
That's what Gary said.
We are staying in the city.
Yeah.
Anybody else who wants to come see us, you are welcome to come visit.
I love it.
You were welcome to come visit because, again, we're in 2018.
That's right. Yes, exactly.
And this week we are covering
Good Morning Peoria. We didn't rehearse that.
We didn't rehearse it at all.
It just happened.
Anyway, so let's get into the TV Guide description.
Before that, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
Directed by Michael Zinberg, written by Chris Rupenthal, aired November the 8th, 1989. Our leap date is September 9th, 1959. And Sam has leapt into Chick Howell.
Howling
Chick Howell.
Radio
DJ.
Yeah.
Tell us what TV Guide says.
TV Guide, Sam Scott Bakula twists and shouts into 1959 as a howling Peoria disc jockey, helping his feisty boss, Patricia Richardson, combat a civic leader who says her station's rock and roll has got to go.
It's got to go! And, you know, I just want to kick this off by saying that this is probably one of my favorite episodes that doesn't have to do with Sam's backstory or family or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Just like one standalone episode.
Yeah.
Yes. It's the same. Yeah, for me, this is an episode that broke my heart on the DVD release because of all of the music replacements.
Yes.
I think this may have been the one where I ended up buying all of the seasons just for posterity, because I thought this is it. This is the only release that it's ever going to get.
Right.
I might as well have them, and 50 years from now, maybe I won't be as bitter about the music. But like watching this episode was like when I was like, I just can't. And when I bought the Blu-rays back at the start of 2017, I do think this was the first episode that I popped in and watched knowing that the music was back.
And you are not alone. Blu-ray.com, which is a wonderful website, I visit quite a bit, and first off, they have this wonderful deal page where they list like all the deals for like a price tracker, basically, on DVDs and Blu-rays. And they do it by lowest price, best deal, newest deal sort of thing. And you can actually see like if a movie is at the lowest price it's ever been, there'll be like a little red bar. It says lowest price. It's great, great useful tool. Anyway, their message boards will spotlight, you know, each release or whatever that's coming out, and they obviously did one for the Quantum Leap Blu-rays, and I can remember, I pre-ordered it, so I wasn't really concerned, but some people got them a little early, and so they started posting immediately, and I would say almost every single person that was checking the music use this as like the first episode they watched. So there are a lot of people out there that watched this episode first when they got their Blu-rays, and then followed it up with MIA, of course.
And I think you tipped me off to it being on Blu-ray. As big of a Quantum Leap fan as I am, I had given up so hard on there ever being another release of anything. Like I didn't even bother looking. And then you tipped me off. It's like, it's on Blu-ray? All right.
Well, that's funny, because I remember your Facebook post. Like, you even posted something on Facebook and like, gave me a shout-out for... Well, it's interesting, too, because before the Blu-rays came out, before they'd been announced, I had been toying with buying the British versions.
I had to,
Because I've got a region-free DVD player, I have a huge collection of Doctor Who DVDs, because... Here's another tip for any Doctor Who fans that are out there. Do buy the US releases. But if you want to save some money, don't. Just buy the original UK releases. Because even with the exchange rate and even with the shipping, they are often 50% cheaper by buying them from Amazon.com UK than they are from buying them here in the States.
That's a shame.
Yeah. Because you can get most of the releases for like £6 to £7, which is like $10-$12. Yeah, anyway.
Do that.
So I have a region-free DVD player, and I was thinking to myself, I was like, you know what, I should just go ahead and buy these, have the music, be able to listen to episodes like Good Morning Peoria and all their glory. Which, speaking of, I'm just going to go ahead and throw this out here now, because why not? You get such hits as Tutti Frutti as performed by Little Richard, April Love by Pat Boone, All Shook Up by Elvis Presley, Maybe Baby by Buddy Holly and the Crickets, Sleepwalk by Santo and Johnny, Great Balls of Fire by Jerry Lee Lewis, Yakety Yak by the Coasters, The Twist by Chubby Checker, Jailhouse Rock by Elvis Presley, Rock Around the Clock by Bill Haley and his Comets, Sea Cruise by Frankie Ford, The Glory of Love by the Five Keys, and Shout as performed by the Isley Brothers, and they are there in their glory, not taken out for rights reasons, and it's quite nice.
It is,
and it reinforces the fact that, you know, this episode relies on that so much for giving us our time and our place. Because one thing that's interesting about this episode is it pretty much takes place in one setting. You know, we don't get a lot. I mean, we get little cuts here and there, but as far as like where Sam is, we only see him in like one place pretty much for the whole episode.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, we get little shots on the street.
Yeah, but. But I will go on again just to reinforce this. It was probably one of my favorite episodes, like non-arc episodes, if you will, or whatever. And I have probably seen this one more times than a lot of other episodes. There's a couple that I know for a fact I've seen a lot more. I mean, there are a couple of episodes, like the season 3 premiere in particular, I've probably seen well into the double digits. But anyway, I'm a fan of this episode, and I'm looking forward to talking about it.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, let's dive in.
Let's do it.
Leap in.
Yes.
Yes.
Let's leap in.
So Sam
keep
is in
the bad
a DJ.
Puns coming.
Yeah, Sam is in a DJ booth, and Tutti Frutti has just ended, and he's kind of at a loss of what to do. And
one thing, I mentioned this on our last episode, the voiceover intro into this episode with the clips from Blind Faith, you could almost hear Scott Bakula wincing at how bad the narration is. But it gets us in there. One thing that happens that it does happen on occasion, but didn't actually happen in Blind Faith, is that we get a much longer leap in than we do in the leap out from the previous episode. So there's more stuff that happens leading up to what we saw last from Sam.
We do.
Where he's fumbling around with the records and dropping things and, you know, and so on and so forth.
And just like this drawn out exchange, which I feel like for reruns, they cut it down. It was one of those things that, it's honestly, I feel like the first scene is made stronger in the rerun because they cut a little unnecessary stuff out of there. But just kind of like this drawn out thing of like he's just like total at a loss, and Patricia Richardson's character, which her name Rachel, has like basically like proverbially like handhold him, like read the paper that is in your hand.
Right, go to the ad.
He looks down. We get a mirror shot of his little stand. His clipboard has a mirror.
And other than Jesse Tyler, might be the oldest person we've seen Sam leap into so far.
I do believe so.
Yeah.
And I think this is a case, this is the only mirror shot that we get in the entire episode.
I think you're right.
I think we're about to say the exact same thing.
You got it. Go for it.
You do see, unfortunately, Scott Bakula's reflection a lot. But, you know, it's a TV show. What?
Right.
What are you going to do?
I certainly don't care.
Yeah. You get a lot of Scott Bakula's reflection in the glass.
There's glass. Yeah, there's glass. What are you going to do about glass?
Yeah. Anyway.
So we get this moment immediately after because he's frozen. And he reads the ad, but it's not a very good read.
No. And I think this is one of we don't get a no boy. At least we don't get it at the beginning. He says, "Oh my God, I'm a DJ."
Yeah,
and I'm not sure if we get an oh boy at all.
I don't think we do. I don't think we do. Actually, we get a variation on the leap out, which is a very funny moment. But I don't think there's an oh boy in this. And it's interesting how Sam, it's the fish out of water sense is something that they always play with in the leap in. But there's also an element where you kind of want to say, at this point, wouldn't Sam maybe be a little bit more gung-ho? Like, wouldn't Sam maybe just kind of be like, okay, this is what I am, this is where I'm going, I'll do it. I mean, I don't mind that he's not. That's not a criticism. I'm just sort of like,
for sure.
It's interesting to think.
But also to justify it, having a microphone right in front of your face is a very,
sure.
is a very powerful thing, too, realizing that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, there's no doubt. It's a funny little moment, and then he goes into the control booth, and Rachel promptly is, all over his case for his terrible delivery and the dead air. And
absolutely. From this, we get the idea that Chuck is a relatively recent hire.
Yes.
Him and Rachel are already kind of off on the wrong foot.
Yep.
They already kind of have this antagonist relationship.
Yeah. And let's go back real quick because it is very funny here. I mentioned all the songs, just a moment ago, but he does put on April Love by Pat Boone. Mm-hmm. And the looks on the faces of both his fellow DJ Leland and Patricia Richardson, Rachel, it's just like, what are you playing?
Mm-hmm.
Like, Chick Howell would never play Pat Boone.
Yes.
So it kind of adds to the whole, tension between them when he walks into the control booth. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's one thing that is kind of cool, and it almost follows up what I was saying about how Sam just sort of diving in, is that in the voiceover, Sam's voiceover, we get this bit where he's just like, some people just rub you the wrong way right off the bat. And Sam immediately launches into like giving her hell back. And it's really cool, and it's really nice, and it's very much kind of like an old, I hate to use the rom-com, but it feels kind of, like screwball comedy sort of back and forth.
Even more so, like, and this is a theme, and this happens throughout dialogue, and obviously like the plot of the episode itself kind of plays on that rom-com trope,
like of moonlighting
but it's just like of having the antagonistic relationship of the person that you really. If you're not in love with, like, you have the hots for, like
that there's,
you're interested in. And so we immediately, yeah.
Yeah. But it's great. And I love that Sam just goes for it and starts kind of giving it to her. And then at one point, he's kind of clearly afraid that he's about to get fired. Mm-hmm. And so he pulls back a little on it. But then she, she does say to him, if you come in late tomorrow, you're going to be fired.
You're going to be fired, yeah. It is interesting to note, Patricia Richardson, who is probably best known for Home Improvement, which started a couple years later.
Four-time Emmy nominee.
Four-time Emmy nominee, Patricia Richardson.
Dang.
For Home Improvement. 2 years before this episode, but a year before Quantum Leap debuted, Scott Bakula and Richardson were in a short-lived 13-episode TV series called Eisenhower and Lutz, which was a sitcom where Sam was, or Scott Bakula, I should say, was like this ne'er-do-well womanizing attorney, and Richardson was one of the other actors on that show.
Yeah.
So this was, I don't know how intentional this was in the casting, but this was kind of like a little mini reunion from them having worked together a couple years before.
And their chemistry, I mean, right off the bat, I think is evident, goes a long way to making this a great episode, I think. They have excellent chemistry. Patricia Richardson is extremely watchable, and you know, just there's something about her that makes me not only want to watch her, but makes me care about Rachel. Mm-hmm. And it goes beyond writing and acting. It's just that sort of innate thing that some people kind of have that make you just kind of want to watch them and see what they're going to mm-hmm. do. Which even later in the episode, like some of her facial expressions in the control booth, mm-hmm. It's just her reactions to Sam are so wonderful, you know, and because they're not over the top, they're just very genuine, honest reactions, but she has a very expressive face and it feels very real. Mm-hmm. And it's just kind of like, man, like I want to watch you.
Yeah. I mean, they do have more of a chance in this episode as opposed to other episodes. Like it is kind of a bottle episode and like,
just getting ready to
say
that.
Yeah. Yep. Like they're sitting in the same room and they get to have like these couple scenes where they just have like these longer, like more settled in.
Yeah.
Conversational scenes that you don't get a whole lot of, and just like their chemistry that they do bounce off of other, it makes it a very easy episode,
right,
to watch.
And the two of them are really, you know, the ones that kind of carry the episode. I mean, they've got the bulk of the dialogue, and you know, I mean, even Al feels sort of secondary to a lot of the stuff going on in this episode.
Not secondary. He's around a lot.
Right, but he doesn't have as much dialogue, I feel like, as he does
for sure. Like he's setting the things up for
them to
spike.
Yes,
proverbially. And I will say this, and this is a weird thing that I've noticed watching, like any TV show that you watch when you're a kid, and then you come back and you revisit the show like later in life. Like watching this show as a kid. And even like, you know, a couple years later, like Patricia Richardson is going to end up like being like the mom on Home Improvement. Like watching the show as a kid, like I saw Patricia Richardson as a mom figure, and I didn't really like think of her as, you know, like an attractive human being, an attractive woman. And like watching the episode this time for the first time, I was like,
oh yeah.
And like looking at her age, like she, in this episode, she is the age that I am.
Yeah.
Now.
Right.
And so, like, watching, I was like, you know, like, I never thought of it, but she's a very attractive woman.
Yeah. Yeah, and would
whereas, like, watching this episode, like, as a little kid.
And she would have been, like, 38, I think, in the episode. Not to give away your age. She definitely... She's attractive. She's without a doubt. She's attractive in this episode, and I think that again, the chemistry and the play between the two, you know, you buy it, and I would agree with what you're saying, that maybe when I watched it as a kid, I did see her as somewhat older, but now watching it now, I definitely don't see her as that.
It's a weird thing. Like when I was a kid, like watching Star-Crossed, I thought Terry Hatcher was, you know,
right? Sure.
It's a weird like. And we go down a huge rabbit hole with this, like,
of course,
traditionally attractive versus however else you want to call it, like attractiveness. But
no, that is interesting. I don't know. I don't want to sit here and sound like we're two salivating teenagers.
That's the thing. I don't want to come across like sounding that way. But
right.
It's interesting, like what your ideas of attractive are as you grow up from being a kid. Up into adulthood.
Right.
I don't think we may not be articulating it very well, but that's all we're trying to say.
There, without a doubt, there are some moments in this episode where she's like downright sultry. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like without a doubt, and it is very. You know, she comes across as being very sexy. You know, and you can tell that Sam feels the same way.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously there's a lot more to her than that, as we have already discussed, and segues nicely into what I'm about to say, because in the very next scene that we get, after Sam does like his sign off, bumbles his sign off and everything, he goes into the hallway and sees her arguing with our primary antagonist, Fred Beeman. One of the advertisers for her radio station.
Mm-hmm.
And first of all, she's like a woman in power. Like, it's her radio station.
Mm-hmm.
In 1959, Peoria, Illinois, and a woman is running the radio station. Mm-hmm. Like, that's cool. And you know, she's going back and forth with him over playing rock and roll. He doesn't want her to play it. He thinks it's, you know, a bad influence on the kids. She thinks that's ridiculous. She's going to play what she wants to play. It's her radio station.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I mean, She's a very three-dimensional character, which I really, really appreciate.
Mm-hmm. The writing slips in one moment in that regard later in the episode. And
I look forward to we'll get to that.
Yeah. Where I feel like they had built her up as a very strong character, and like in this one weird like two-minute segment, all of a sudden she becomes something different.
Okay.
But we'll talk about that later.
Yeah. No, I look forward to that. And Sam jumps in to try to help, and it's fascinating because all of a sudden she's like, she's still sticking to her guns with Fred, but at the same time there's this element of like she doesn't really want Sam's help at all, and it's and there's this weird moment where it's just sort of like, okay, you're helping me, but I don't like you and I don't want your help,
mm-hmm.
but okay, you're helping me, so I'll let you help me.
And I was watching this scene. This is another scene that if you watch it in reruns it gets cut down extensively. And I do think this is another case where this scene is actually made stronger by editing it down.
Oh, really? Okay.
It's more in the reruns. But it is interesting, like one scene that that is in the longer version that's not the rerun, I can't remember what exactly the line was, but there's this one thing that Sam says, and it's not articulated well at all, and he kind of fumbles through it. And like, as soon as he gets it out, like Scott Bakula does this thing, like, what the fuck did I just say? And it's a nice moment of like, he realizes, like, he is not, like, he's trying to help, but he's not helping the situation.
Yeah.
To speak to what you're saying, like, yeah, it's nice that you're helping, but stop mansplainer. I got it.
Sure. Yeah. Well, and one thing that I never would have even thought of this, and I think that we probably have plenty of listeners that are fully aware of what I'm about to say, but there's a chance that maybe we have some, you know, listeners that aren't as in tune, but this is absolutely true. I mean, this happened in the 50s and even into the 60s, where you had organizations or people, you know, of some power or stature in communities that were indeed going for an all-out ban on rock and roll music, that it promoted some sort of juvenile delinquency. You had people on air breaking records because they you know, swear, I'm not going to play this devil's music. And I mean, that was a real thing. Like, this actually happened, and it wasn't just in the Bible Belt or whatever. It was like all over the country there were stations that would refuse to play some of this music, whether it was because some people thought that it was, you know, black music, or some people thought that it was too racy, or some people thought that it would, you know, that it promoted some sort of violence or sex or drug use or whatever the case may have been. And so there were people that were actually working towards some sort of ban of this music. And you even had record companies that would try to pay radio stations not to play certain songs. On the flip side, you had, no pun intended, you had music companies paying people to play certain music as well. So it's fascinating to think about that being the case, because this episode, you know, it's not just pure fantasy. I mean, this is a real, these were really things that were happening.
When was the last time we've had music like that? Like, where people, like, actually trying to put a ban on it. Because, like, the last time I remember,
I mean,
in recent history of adults, like, really flipping out over music and what effect it has on kids is Marilyn Manson back in the late 90s.
Yeah, that would probably be it. I know that Eminem faced some of that. I mean, he might really be one of the last ones to do that. There's actually a fascinating article about Eminem comparing him to Elvis Presley in a lot of ways, and how, you know, by taking... Now, whatever, I don't want to get into all that. Anyway, yeah, but Marilyn Manson, Nirvana certainly faced some of that. NWA faced a lot of that. I mean, there was a lot, Ice-T, and, you know, there's a lot of rap artists that certainly, you know, struggled, I think, with people trying to get them thrown off the air, or get companies to not sell their music. But I would say that it was more more a case of an artist being singled out because of something that they did. Whereas in the 50s, we're talking about the entire genre.
Absolutely, yeah.
It was if you played music that sounded like this at all, you're promoting something that we don't like.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, let's face it. You know, there's an entire generation of kids that was all they wanted. That's what they grew up on.
Mm-hmm.
And it really didn't stop, you know, I mean, in my estimation, it probably didn't stop based on what I know until shortly after the Beatles stopped touring, because there were, you know, when Lennon made the comment about them being, you know, in some people's minds or whatever, that they were bigger than Jesus. And you know, there was all the people breaking their records and burning their records. There were literally meetings where it was like, bring your Beatles records in, we're going to burn all your records. And you know, there's film footage of like kids like throwing their Beatles records onto the, you know, the bonfire and all this sort of stuff. But I think that was sort of the, you know, the death rattle of that in a lot of ways, because shortly after it was just sort of like, well, they're still around and they're still making music and, you know, you're not going to stop them. And, you know, people didn't care quite as much. And there was always something, you know, I mean, before you knew it, you had Alice Cooper and you had, you know, it's like there's always something new that was kind of pushing the envelope. But I think in a lot of ways, there'd never been anything quite like that mid to late 50s sort of
era where they're trying to take like one genre of music and not.
This is leading you to the path of damnation.
Anyway.
Parents.
So Fred Beeman is the face of all of that in this episode.
Yeah.
And
Rachel won't back down.
No. And we get the idea, or we get established that Fred is an established member of the community. He owns the newspaper. He owns a hardware store. And as we're about to find out, he clearly has some influence over the city council. And
he's proposed a new bill.
And the mayor. And we got from... Yeah, we go from zero to like, you know, I'm going from just please stop playing the music. All right, I'm proposing whatever, a bill or whatever you want to call it.
Well, I think because of the way she stands up to him and the way she's just like, I am not backing down from you at all. I'm going to play my music. And he's like, fine, I'm pulling my advertising. I'm proposing a bill to do this. I'm, you know, and both Sam and Rachel are like, you're crazy. Like, no way. This will never happen.
And anyway.
Yeah.
So, and this is where we get, like, afterwards, we get the short moment. Al shows up during all of this. Like, he's just, like, kind of in the background, and he's kind of, like, contributing to the conversation a little bit. And Sam asks him, like, could they actually pass something? And Al's like,
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's, like, graffiti on Chick's car.
That's when we get out, this is when Rachel says, if you're late again tomorrow, you're fired, and she storms off, and so now... They're walking out, and this is when Al drops it, that the original history, the station is stopped from playing rock and roll, the station tanks, and a weird thing, like, Sam is just not there to save the station, but he has to make sure that the station is number one.
Yeah. It's interesting, too, because you think in the scheme of things, with the stakes of other episodes that we've had, this doesn't quite seem as high, and yet... It's just very well done. So even though it's not about somebody dying, you know, or getting married or, you know, all the things that the three main things that we said earlier.
For sure. I mean, like, without beating your overhead, it's established, like, if not only if the station doesn't survive and thrive, but if the station is not number one, Rachel is not going to have a fulfilling life.
Right.
And that's part of the thing.
Yeah.
So he gets to his car, like this like sweet ride, like this Corvette, and someone has in very neat handwriting with soap, like Chuck Chick, no more.
Go home.
No more rock and roll, something like that. No, go home. You're thinking of Americanization of Machigo.
Anyway. Try not to.
No, yeah. Chuck Chick, yeah, no more. Rock and roll, and it is interesting. Like, we established, like, Fred Beeman is the face. Like, he's the bad guy in this episode. He obviously has goons doing the dirty work for him. You never see him in this episode.
No, it's kind of crazy too because there's a huge cast of extras in this episode.
There is,
like, as far as speaking roles go, not a ton of them, and most of the lines, like I said, are Sam and Rachel's. But there's this gigantic cast of extras for, you know, for these, like, scenes at the malt shop and scenes outside the gas station and
outside the radio station. Yeah,
And so Sam does arrive early the next day, so he keeps Chick's job, which is important.
2:46 to spare, I think he says.
Yeah. And then Al, he starts going through the records with Al to try and figure out what he should play. And of course, Rachel sees this from the control booth. And, you know, it's like, what is he doing?
There's this line about, what are you going to play first? What's your first album? something by the Beatles. Who are the Beatles?
Yeah, you mean the Crickets?
Yeah.
Beatles, Crickets.
They're all related. Yeah.
Because he's a little early on that. Apparently he doesn't remember much music or what to talk about. But then Al starts giving him suggestions, helping him out, and then all of a sudden says the words, "Didn't you see the movie?"
Mm-hmm.
And the next thing we get is, sure enough, is Sam in Robin Williams mode.
We are aping. I'm going to make a confession.
Yeah.
I've never seen Good Morning Vietnam.
Oh!
Never seen it. I thought maybe I should watch it in preparation for this one, but I just did a quick synopsis on Wikipedia. I was like, all right, I get the connection.
I saw the film probably pretty close to when I saw this episode. And I watched it by myself in the den at our house in Independence, Missouri, where I watched a lot of Quantum Leap episodes as well. And it was... I don't know that I had ever had as strong of an emotional reaction to something as I had to that film. And there's a scene towards the end of the movie where Wonderful World is playing and Louis Armstrong singing the song and Robin Williams' character is walking through the streets and, you know, all hell is breaking loose. And it just slayed me. I mean, I was like 8-9 years old and I just remember bawling and it had such a profound effect on me. It's a wonderful film, and I mean, Robin Williams is incredible in it. It's one of those films that does such an incredible job of striking the balance between the comedy and then the more serious elements that it would be a struggle to think of as many other movies that do the same thing. Mm. I mean, it's fantastic, and he's incredible in it, and Scott Bakula does a wonderful job of going full blast with
aping.
Yeah,
even never having seen the movie, I've seen enough clips. Like even like watching this episode for the first time as a kid, like I got the
yeah, and it works, and it's funny, and he does a wonderful job with it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a point even in the episode where he talks about like how exhausted he is from doing all this sort of stuff, and you could just tell it's like, yeah, that's probably exhausting, you know. And if mm-hmm. he had to do multiple takes of some of these things, like it's like that's work. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And it's also important to note, like, this was just, like, 2 years after... Yeah, this was just 2 years after Good Morning Vietnam. So, yeah, they're aping a pretty
recent...
Yeah.
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 And doing it well, you mm-hmm. know? And I think because... I don't know. It just works, and I've always liked it. And, mm-hmm. and again, you know, even watching it earlier today, I never, like, sat there and... Sometimes you see things like that, and you get that sort of like cringe, like where you're embarrassed for the person that had to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just sort of like, oh, you had to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the case with this at all.
No, yeah. No. Yeah, it works. And it's in like watching this episode this time, like, I don't know why, but I always assumed that this is what Chick Hal would do. Like, that was his thing. But then, like, watching everybody's reaction in the courtroom, like, no, like, that's not his style at all.
And
now when he leaps back, that has to be his style.
Right? Well, and getting those facial expressions, like I was talking about earlier, from, like, Patricia Richardson and, mm-hmm. and the guy that plays Leland, like, it's just sort of, there is this look of just sort of like, what the, who the...
Yeah.
Okay.
But hey. Like,
yeah.
Hey, this is awesome.
This is good stuff. Like, wow, where did this come from?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's talking about the Russians in space and Khrushchev being on the end of the next missile,
mm-hmm.
and just all sorts of stuff, you know, that would have been very, very period appropriate for 1959.
Yeah.
And
great bits, and then intercut with this. They have a lot of dance scenes about on the street of everybody.
And this is where we're getting, we're getting
mm-hmm.
a lot of the good... really good music.
It pains me. I don't know if I want to go back and see what this looks like on DVD.
Oof.
With all these,
all
this dancing.
How
yeah.
could you?
But yeah, we get the scenes of the teenagers dancing and Beeman and his entourage being annoyed
mortified.
by all of this. And yeah, there are just some great bits that Sam and Al do. And then I do believe it. Yeah, this is the scene where, yeah, it gets ruined by the brick coming through
the window. Before that happens, we get the Chubby Checker moment. I'm pretty sure. Yeah, it is. We get the Chubby Checker moment before that happens.
Okay.
And Al sees Chubby Checker and he goes and he freaks out.
That's right, that's right. Yes, yes. Yeah. How and can we forget the Chubby Checker moment?
A 47-year-old Chubby Checker plays a 17-year-old version of himself.
You know, watching this episode as a kid, it didn't, but
no.
I'm going to allow it.
Yeah.
I mean, this is just good, kitschy, nostalgic fun. I mean, I would say for the short cameo that it is.
Yes.
If you have to choose between what they did and getting some lookalike younger person to play him and having to take the extra time and exposition to make sure that the audience knows that it's Chubby Checker, I will take what they did.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It is a cool moment. It fits in perfectly well with the episode, what the episode's going for. And, you know, you get the kiss with history where Sam basically teaches him the twist, which he's already got a song called The Twist, so why wouldn't he have a dance
move
but
for
that? Yes.
But
it's funny. It's a cute moment. It's great. Sam and Al are going, you know, are going nuts.
Everybody's
over
dancing.
It.
Like, the dancing. Receptionist is dancing. Yeah. Everybody's getting
Rachel's
into
dancing
it.
And she's going down, you know, the hallway with the record because Sam's like, if you play this record, we will be a number one radio station. You
yeah.
Know? And yeah, so it's a good scene with a lot of energy, and it's fun. So yeah, I agree. But it is just funny to note that here he is playing himself 30 years younger in the scene.
But to jump back, I just watched this episode this morning. I should remember because I thought it was like the brick came through the window. They got the console repaired, and then it was after they got the music turned back on. That's when they looked over and saw that.
Not according to my
to your notes. Okay, I'm gonna take your I'll take
or
your
the Quantum Leap Wikia from what I'm reading.
Okay, yeah. All right.
Because actually, oddly enough, it seems as though they don't get the brick thrown through until after they go to the council meeting.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Which does actually seem out of order. I don't know.
I do, yeah, because I feel like they get the console repaired, then they see Chubby Checker, and then somewhere in here there's a line where Sam says, no one is going to ban rock and roll, get the hard cut to them coming out of the council meeting saying, I can't believe that they banned rock and roll. And where this is where Rachel starts having the doom and gloom of, you know, that's it. I might as well close the station down. Might as well, get ready for the Dark Ages, you know, bring up the drawbridges. And that's what gives Sam the idea of barricading themselves in the door.
Right.
Barricading themselves in the station. And this in the scene where Al basically, like, he lays out, like, here's what's going to happen if they stop playing rock and roll.
Yeah.
The station is going to be closed within a year. Which is weird now that I think about it. Like, Al doesn't give... like what happens in the original history, like he gives a projection. Oh, like he doesn't say, yeah, they banned rock and roll in the original history. This happened. Like Al is giving a projection that Ziggy's given. Like, yeah, well, yeah, she can like last for about a year if she stops paying salaries. But yeah,
right,
yeah,
yeah, but it's pretty, pretty ominous. Yeah, I mean, it's. Regardless of what the proper order is, I'm pretty sure the twist thing happens before, actually.
Sure. Well, yeah.
But regardless, yeah, the law gets passed.
Timing off in a time travel.
There is. Yeah.
Anyway.
There's going to be a ban on rock and roll music. Mm-hmm. They can't believe it. And Rachel ends up having that line that you mentioned about raising the drawbridge and preparing for the Dark Ages, which gives Sam the idea to barricade themselves in. You know, they get in, they get on the air, they're going to make a protest against the new law. Sam reads the letter from Fred's you know, talking about how half-articulate speech of long-haired radicals is all that rock and roll music is, and then follows it up by reading what he prefaces by saying another document by a bunch of long-haired radicals, which is the First Amendment of the Constitution, and says that they're going to stay on the station and that they're going to, you know, play their rock and roll music. And it's hilarious because he does this impassioned thing. They play the music. He sits back. The phone rings. And Sam is just sort of like, for you. Yeah, and Rachel's like my hero.
Well, before this, we get a scene of Fred and his entourage, like in the local diner, which to me, I mean, I know it's not the same thing. It just immediately put me in mind of the cafe in Back to the Future.
Yeah.
That we see. Yeah. But like them gloating, like, that rock and roll is no more in Peoria, and they're all very happy and celebrating, except for Fred's wife. Who was just very happy and just like, I don't know.
Yeah.
It's just music. What's going on? And then we get the scene that you just described of them saying they're not going to do it anymore. And then they cut back to Fred, clearly unhappy that.
And so he calls Rachel, and Rachel, and again, it's just Patricia Richardson being awesome. She has this such a sweet delivery of just like, well, this is exactly what we're going to do, and that's all there is to it. And, you know, as opposed to just being like, no, I am standing up to you. It's just this really, like, it's just a really great moment she has. It's very simple. And there are a couple of other times she'll talk on the phone with him and, you know, and kind of raise the stakes each time. But she's just like, I'm going to stand my ground, and that's all there is to it. And and so now they're serious. This is happening.
Yeah. One thing I find noteworthy here, this where you see it, like, particularly in this scene, is that this is, you know, even though we had, like, the day before where we had this period of time where, like, Sam went home for the night and he came in for work the next morning, so we didn't see all that. But for the rest of the episode, it plays out in real time as close as you get.
Yeah.
In real time-ish. Like, it takes place overnight. And it's interesting where it's like, if you're watching it on TV, interrupted by a commercial break, yeah, whatever. But, like, watching it on DVD or Blu-ray, where you have no commercial break, it's interesting because they start playing Bill Haley in the Comets, and it ends with all three of them in the control room.
Yeah.
Sam, Rachel, and Al. I think the last line going into the commercial break, Al, who, by the way, thinks this is a horrible idea, which I have a hard time believing.
Right.
I would think Al would think this is a great idea.
Oh, yeah. Especially because Sam's alone with a woman in
enclosed
space. Like,
yeah.
Al would be all for this.
Yeah. But his last line right before the commercial break is, well, if we're going to go down in flames, I'll help you pick out the records.
Yeah.
And so they're all three in the control room. We go to commercial break. When we come back, the song is almost in the exact same spot from when they went to the commercial break. But Rachel is coming back in from the other room, having retrieved the editorial that you just mentioned.
Yeah, okay.
So to me, like, it kind of establishes this this idea that we're kind of seeing time accelerated, like, throughout the night.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Well, just the convention of, you know, television.
Convention, there we go, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and then, of course, we start getting, you know, all these obstacles thrown at them. Yeah, there's the vandal throws the brick. It destroys the control panel. Sam has to fix it. There's a really nice moment where, like, Rachel's talking about how her dad built the control panel.
And this is, one of those conversational scenes that we talked about, yeah.
Yeah, and it's just a really nice moment, and Sam gets it fixed, and she's, you know, surprised that he could do it. And he makes a comment at one point about Apple, about how, like,
when they were repairing the console, yeah.
Yeah, and because she's like, my dad, you know, worked at night in his garage and blah, blah, blah. And she's like, oh, just like the guys at Apple. And she's like, what? And he's like, Wapple. W-A-P-L in New York.
Sure. Quick thinking. Good one. And I love, and then the scene where they're locked in having the long conversation about her dad or whatever. Like, she comments, like, the future radio is FM.
Yeah.
Not AM, such as they are.
Right.
Well, I mean, which is interesting because, wink, wink. Yeah, wink,
right.
Wink. It's true. And also, after this, Patricia Richardson will be on another short-lived series before Home Improvement called
FM,
which features a lot of actors from the previously mentioned Eisenhower and Lutz.
Yeah,
all except for Scott Bakula, obviously, because he was busy. Yeah, he was busy. Doing another show.
And then, yeah, it would be shortly after that show ended that she ended up doing Home Improvement, which she, you know, was like 8, 9 seasons long or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there are some really nice moments that they're having, and they're continuing their conversation, and, you know, of course, Fred's like, well, their music's back on, I gotta do something else to get it off, so he has the power cut, lights go off, there's this scene in Shuffle in the Darkness, Sam accidentally bumps into Rachel, and he's like, I was looking for the doorknob, and she has this great line where she's like, the doorknob's usually lower, it's just sort of like, what did Sam do?
Yeah, what? I mean, it's kind of like, in the silhouette, they kind of imply, yeah, like where right. he, yeah, where he grabbed what he grabbed.
Yeah. And you know, it's just, it's a funny moment, and it's played well. And then they have a generator, and he's like, I've got a, you know, I'll get things back up.
Mm-hmm.
He has this line about, you know, separating the men from the boys.
They can't get the generator started.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then
they work together to
do it. Yeah.
To get it started, and
now they've got power back, but they've only got enough power to generate the radio and not the air conditioner, so now it's hot.
That's right, yeah.
And Rachel started to kind of unbutton her dress a little bit, and this is what I was talking about with the sultry kind of, like, you know, it's fuck it, it's a hot moment. It is, you know, I mean, she's
literally.
Yeah. And so he calls again, you know, talking about how he's not even going to return giving his advertising, even if they do stop playing the rock and roll.
And how he's going to get everybody else to join in. Meanwhile, he's telling, his name is Foley. It's on his name badge because that was a weird name. He's telling the police chief to, like, bust the door down, arrest her, and everybody else involved is like, yeah, what they're doing is wrong, but this is not bust down the door and drag them out.
Yeah.
Wrong. Slow your roll. And I do believe it's somewhere around this point where she says, after I hang up the phone with you, I'm calling every news organization in the country. And this is an example of accelerated time. Same song is playing. I'm going to call every news organization in the country. Next shot, Chicago.
Yeah.
Chicago pulls in.
Which, let's face it, in 1959 America, it probably would have taken, like, a good 2.5 hours, if not more, to get from Chicago to Peoria.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, in real time, this barricade probably would have played out over 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
But, like I said, we're seeing some accelerated time.
Accelerated, did you say?
Accelerator!
Like a quantum leap accelerator.
Right there, yeah. Very noteworthy.
So, yeah, indeed. And I think it's somewhere around here when we get the line about how she tells him to take the nightstick and shove it. Which is another great line. It's just delivered with, you know, pure honey off the words, and yet just as vicious, you know. Another great example of Patricia Richardson just cutting it up.
Yeah, and I really, we talked about this, I think, off mic before we started recording, is that Fred's character is so...
Yeah.
He is so thin, and I realized, like, watching this episode, like, the reason why it was never obvious to me watching this as a kid is because... That particular actor, that character, he just physically looks like a guy from my hometown.
Mm-hmm.
He was a very well respected member of our community. He was deacon in the church. He was a music teacher throughout the middle school and the high school. He just very much looked like him.
Okay.
Like, if Fred Beeman was a good guy,
it
would be this guy from my hometown. And I realized, like, when I was a kid, like, I kind of put them in my same headspace. Like, I imbued the nice guy from my hometown in there. But watching this episode, now I'm like, no, like, the actor does the best he can with it, but he's just a very thinly drawn character.
And you know, he's another one of those actors, if you will. Richard McKenzie did just a lot of work, you know, for 30, 40 years, a lot of it in television. You know, hit most of the big ones, starting with My Three Sons, did the Waltons, Hawaii Five-O, the Jeffersons. He was in Roots.
I could totally see him in an episode of the Waltons.
Yeah. He was on Quincy. All in the Family, played Alfred Bunker. He was Archie's brother. How about that?
That's priceless. Could totally see that.
But yeah, I just, you know, a ton of stuff. Soap, In the Heat of the Night, MacGyver, you know, just a lot of television stuff. It doesn't look like he's done anything in about 15 years or so, but I mean, he was born in 1930, so he's obviously getting up there. But anyway, it is interesting. The comment I made to you is that we almost learn more about Fred Beeman from the letters that Sam reads on the air than we do anything that Fred Beeman does or says, other than that he hates rock and roll.
Mm-hmm.
So at this point, it's hot, sweltering. They've been in there for a while. They're trying to relax. They continue to bond some. Sam puts on some romantic music, mm-hmm. The Glory of Love,
dedicated to the woman that.
There's no one else he'd rather spend the night in a fallout shelter with.
Civil defense shelter with.
And so they start dancing and they kiss. And again, the chemistry, I mean, legit, like the chemistry between the two of them is excellent. I mean, it's palpable. And there's nothing about the dance or the kiss that feels like cheesy or cliched. Mm-hmm. It just feels right and it works. And then, of course, after they kiss, Rachel gets pissed and basically blames Chick for setting this whole thing up in order to get her alone.
No, that's not yet. That doesn't happen just not quite yet. So she slaps him, she pulls away, and she's like, no, you're taking advantage of me in a weak moment. And that's when Sam says, I think you were starting to like it.
Right, okay.
And then Al, that's when he comes up with the line, comes in like, hey, it's you only pull the pigtails of the one you love.
Yeah.
And we could go down a deep, dark rabbit hole of... And we talked about this a few episodes ago with What Price Gloria. Just like, in this day and age, like the problematic trope of playing hard to get and being antagonistic means you actually...
Right.
Like someone.
Right.
Anyway.
I would say, I think I even mentioned this like all the way back in one of our first episodes. I think that there is certainly something to be said for, not necessarily persistence, but you gotta read the room. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
you
absolutely.
Just gotta read the room. And no always means no, but it doesn't always mean you can't try again if you're going about it the right way. You know? So yeah, I agree. It is
absolutely, and like we're not quite there yet, but even still, like this is one of those moments. Like I felt like they had built Rachel up to be a really strong character, like she built this station herself, and she's sticking to her guns, and then she gets in this moment where she's making out with Sam, making out with Chuck, and then all of a sudden, like she gets cold feet, like you're taking advantage of me. What are you doing? It's kind of like
sure,
like why? I mean, I guess in like the over arc of the episode,
right.
Like we need to have that. But we're not quite to the moment that really annoyed me yet.
Okay.
But anyway, so Al's like coaching Sam, like, here's how you go back in. And Sam's like, I know how to do this. I don't need your help. And so they work their way back out to making out again. We cut to Al goes to see what's going on outside.
Yeah.
They've cut the antenna. And then Al comes back in and says, they've cut the antenna. I guess we're off the air.
Yeah. And then
permanently.
And that's when she says that it was all a trick to be alone. And
that's the part of the episode that really bugs me,
yeah.
is when she has this meltdown and she goes to this weird place where she accuses Sam of creating this entire situation just to get alone with her.
Yeah.
That's where I'm just like, why? Why?
Yeah, I can see where you're coming from. I guess it doesn't bother me quite as much, and I can certainly sit there and say it's late, she's tired, she's exhausted,
sure.
She's high strung, it's, all sorts of shit is happening, she's probably a little confused about what just happened with Chick, it's like, it's just sort of like, so I'm willing to give her a pass, but I definitely see where you're coming from with it. I definitely see where you're coming from with that, because I agree, it does sort of betray some of what has been set up for her as a character.
Just having like this weird freak out and just accusing him of like this like really complicated conspiracy just to get her alone and make out.
It's like, what?
Like you say, like even you
set
up. You
must have a mighty high opinion of yourself.
Yeah,
Rachel.
You even set up like Fred to call you and blah blah blah.
Yeah.
Anyway, but Fred calls to gloat.
Right.
And she has made the line, when it rains, it pours. And after the phone conversation, that triggers the thing.
What are the guys made
of? What is good is like copper, boom, and all of a sudden we've turned into an episode of MacGyver.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But Sam gets up there and he's able to restore the transmission with the antenna and using the copper gutters. And then.
But we do get this weird moment of Sam standing standing next to the antenna. And for some reason, him standing too close to the antenna creates
some sort of weird feedback.
Like a leap effect, complete with like both the light show and the same sound is leaping.
It's like, Sam, I'm leaping!
And, and afterwards, I've always found it funny, like when he finds out he's not leaping, he's like, ah!
Yeah, he's like, darn it!
Nuts! And I'm like, I don't know if it ever struck me, just like, does Al really want to time travel? Does he really...
Yeah, I don't know.
What's funny is, not to give any spoilers away from like later on in the series, in case anyone happens to be watching along with, but Dean Stockwell was never crazy about the idea of having to be the leaper.
Interesting.
Because basically it would have been more a complicated shooting schedule for him.
Sure.
But anyway. But yeah, that moment always struck me as odd. I was like, do you really want to travel through time now?
So I think what I would say to that is quite possibly yes. And the reason why I say that is that here's a guy, he was an astronaut. Like, this guy's clearly an explorer. This guy's clearly, you know, and he was part of the Starbright project. He helped start Project Quantum Leap with Sam. So there, I do think that there's enough of an adventurous sense about him that maybe yes. I don't think that psychologically, which will be interesting to maybe even talk about more later, I don't know that he would really be suited for it or for the long haul. You know what I mean?
For sure.
Like, I think that I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. That's it'd be interesting to think about that.
And I will say, yeah, if you've never read the novels, listeners, there are a couple of novels. One, it happens by accident, and another one, Al intentionally leaps. In order to accomplish something.
It's crazy stuff. I recently actually did, I had a few of them already, but I did recently purchase the rest of the novels that I don't have. And I do believe it is my intention for sure, and I think Dennis is pretty much on board with this, that at some point we will actually delve into that aspect.
Cover those?
Yeah. It'll be a while, but...
It'll be a while. I'm trying to think of like, the timing of the novels, and I think... Well, I think almost all of them... Like the timing of the novels, like, the stories of the novels, almost all of them take place after most of the episodes of the series, with the exception of the one novel, which is...
Prelude,
which is, like, the 5 years leading up to the first leap.
And then there are a few episodes, and I always had a little bit of a problem, there are a few novels that actually do take place within, like, in between episodes.
Mm-hmm.
And I just always thought that was kind of weird, because it was like... Yeah, but he leaps out and we see him leap in. But then you get into reruns and you get into how, you know, What Price Gloria, for instance. Like, there's all sorts of leap outs that he doesn't actually go into the next leap or what. So, fine. It's fine.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
So, now we cut to Fred gloating outside, and he's being interviewed by a reporter that I think we've seen before. And this is the thing, watching the episode this time, it's kind of muddy what Fred's intentions are. Like, early on in the episode, like, he purely thinks he is just doing this for the good of the community. Like, he really does think that rock and roll is bad news. But he is such a cocky ass in this scene where he's being interviewed. He's like, well, I just want what's best for America, and anything that's not great for America, gotta do away with it.
Dennis, he's just trying to make America great again.
Nah. And, like, what he was saying, like, you can lift that dialogue out and you can put it into any Republican conservative's mouth now. And, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an election coming up.
Anyway.
So there is a, the music starts to play again
because
they're back.
Actually, it's not the music. It's just Sam's voice coming back over, like talking.
Just saying that.
Like something like, man, if they keep this up, I don't have to change my name to something or whatever. And then someone comes running up and says, hey, they're back on the air.
Yeah.
Like, damn it to hell.
Yeah.
And he goes to turn on the radio. Yeah.
And then this is around the time when, you know, Beeman loses it. and is going to go to the door and with an axe and start to break down the door.
We transition from nighttime to daylight very quick. And this is where we see like fights breaking out.
Yeah.
Between in the red are the pro rock and roll kids.
And in the blue.
And in the blue are... what are the
straight lace?
The straight lace. Yeah. What were they called in the Outsiders?
Oh, the Socias.
The Socias.
Yeah, the Greasers. Yeah, the Socias.
Yeah. Yeah, the Socias or whatever. And like, those are the goons that have been doing all this stuff.
That's right. They're the Pat Boone listening, graffiti painting, just only hands over the clothes stuff doing goons.
Yeah.
But we get the rumble, if you will. All hell's starting to break loose. And it's around this time when Al tells Sam that Ziggy's found something, and it turns out...
Yeah, because now Fred is like, he's actually got the axe. He's
breaking down the door. Mm-hmm. And at one point, they try to like lift a couch up to further barricade the door, and they can't do it. And you know, then Al says that they've got something, and it turns out that a young Fred Beeman, about 14 years prior to this, when this episode takes place, had written an article about...
An editorial about what it meant, like why we fought in World War
II. Thinking about the soldiers that didn't come back, or the soldiers that came back and they weren't quite whole, and the, you know, and this sort of stuff. I mean, you know, why did we fight? And of course, you know, comes up that they fought for freedom—the freedom, the freedom to do what they wanted to do, and including listen to the music they wanted to listen to.
Yeah,
and so you know, Sam says on the air, "Well, all we want is a little freedom too."
Mm.
And Beeman has this breakdown and say, it was different. It was, you know, that's not what I was talking about. And it's clear at this point he's lost, you know.
Yeah.
And that's when his wife comes over and it's just sort of like, come on, Fred, let's go, you know.
Oh, were we to live in a time when you could actually take honorable words and use that to win the day.
Yeah. And it's cool because this isn't the first time that it's happened in the episode, because earlier in the episode, you know, he uses the First Amendment against him. He's like, it is kind of really cool the way that these statements get made within the context of the episode, and, you know, and how they're used. And it's obviously extremely satisfying that they end up using something that he wrote himself to kind of prove how much of a hypocrite he's being, and B, you know, silence these critics and realize that it's just sort of like at the end of the day, if you think this music is going to make me act a certain way and you don't want me to act that certain way, maybe you should look at the fact that maybe I want to act that way. Mm-hmm. I want to wear these clothes. You know, I want to go to Lookout Hill and park with Johnny. I want, you know what I mean? It's like, it's just this cutting off of all the freedom or whatever, and thinking that, you know, Elvis Presley is promoting juvenile delinquency because of the way he combs his hair. It's like, come on. And the fact that they could take such an eloquent stand against all of that, you know, and again, using his own words against him, it works.
Yeah. How quickly, I mean, they just got to that editorial.
That's true.
Here we go. Yeah, find it in the book right here. Because it was just like I was saying, like, how else could they have done that scene? Like, they could have had like Al with his hand link like right in front of Sam's face, like reading it off the hand link.
Yeah.
But then Rachel would have been like, "What the hell did you know?
What
the fuck is from memory? You just moved to town. Shut up."
Oh man! But you're right. The you know, the eloquent words being used, and it kind of reminded me in some ways of Boston Legal. At the end of almost every episode of Boston Legal, James Spader would usually have some sort of, you know, socially conscious monologue that he would give, and it would always be very well done, you know, using facts to support it, very passionate. And one of my favorite ones that he has, actually, at some point...
I think you're about ready, to say the same one that I'm thinking of.
Because he gets tired, and he's just like, I'm tired of having to do this. And it's almost like he's breaking the fourth wall, because he's just sort of like... But there are a couple that have to do with, like, free speech in particular, and one that I'm thinking of right now is... Yeah, it's just his assistant or secretary rather has basically told the IRS that she's not going to pay her taxes because she doesn't believe in the way that her money's being used is effective, and of course he's told her this whole time. He's like, okay, you have to pay your taxes, but he still, you know, defends her in court, obviously, and gives this rousing speech about freedom of speech and about her, you know, what really upset the IRS is the fact that she told them to stick it, you know, and literally wrote that like on the envelope when she sent it back, and that, you know, freedoms are worth fighting for, and you know, and all this sort of stuff. And she ends up being found guilty, they lose, but the judge has heard the speech, and so the judge basically just sentences her to time served, and she doesn't have to pay like any penalty. She just has to pay, you know, whatever. So it's like, so she thinks that, you know, she's lost, and he just looks at her and he's like, "No, you won, you know, it's over."
That's awesome. No, I was thinking there was one episode where James Spader's character, I can't remember his character's name now. He has
Alan Shore
has to go to Texas to argue for the case of a mentally ill man that's going to be put to death, and someone gives him the advice that when you're dealing with Texas judges, like, anytime you get frustrated, just say, "May it please the court."
Yeah.
And so in his very impassioned speech at the end of the episode, he just peppers the phrase, May it please the court through like every third sentence he just throws that in there. That's what I,
No, that's a great one. Death Be Not Proud, that's the episode. I know exactly which one you're talking about.
Yeah.
That's a fantastic episode.
But anyway, were we in a time when honorable words could win the day?
Which is one of the reasons why I brought that show up, actually, is because it was such a, you know, not to use the phrase again, it was such a death rattle, because I feel like, you know, here these honorable, reasonable, passionate words are being used, and they're out there on primetime television, and it's just like no one was fucking listening, because if they were, we wouldn't be where we are right now. So, yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
So Fred gets walked away, and they come out of the barricade, and this is the first time I've ever notice this. I think this is like one of the downfalls of having things in such high quality on Blu-ray.
Sure.
Is, you know, obviously when they're inside the station, they're on a set somewhere. And when they're outside on the street, they're in a completely different location on a back lot somewhere. And so when Scott Bakula and Richard and Patricia Richardson come out of the station, there is nothing behind those front doors except just a blank white wall.
Yeah.
Like there's obviously nothing back behind there.
It's great. Oh God. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's great.
But anyway, so they come out, everybody's dancing. I do believe are we back to Tutti Frutti again?
I do believe so. Oh no, Shout.
That's right. Yeah.
Shout
and we find out that the station goes on to be number one, and a year later, Chuck and
Rachel
get married, and
and
it's really, I mean, like, this is a episode, like, it borders on, fantasy isn't the right word, but, you know, you have these extended dance sequences of kids in the street, you know, dancing or whatever, and then, so you have this, the episode ends on a fun note of Chuck and Leland, that's his name, howling, and then we're...
Right, and there's this cute moment between Sam and Rachel where, you know, he echoes out, get married. He's like, married. And Rachel's like, well, you know, buy me breakfast first. And she's like, but after you finish your shift.
Yeah.
And again, it's just a great moment. It's a wonderful little capstone to the relationship that's been built up between the two of them. Mm-hmm. And again, I think that it doesn't always happen, unfortunately. And that's not to say that, you know, it needs to be this every time. But the chemistry between the two of them, the relationship that's developed, I mean, Patricia Richardson's performance in general, it's just so well done. And I think when Quantum Leap is at its best, you get those types of things, you know, those types of relationships, those types of, and so, yeah, it's great.
Mm-hmm.
And again,
and I realize, like, thinking about it, like, this is an episode where, like Sam is, like, really playful. Like, it's an antagonistic thing, but he's, like, really playful with his co-stars, where sometimes, like, he is the very earnest savior.
Yeah.
Always saying the right thing. Like, he doesn't get a chance in a lot of episodes to just have fun.
Yeah. And it's interesting because you do kind of get the genuine sense that, and it works for a lot of reasons because Chick is new. You get the genuine sense that, you know, Sam is attracted to this woman, that Sam is like, he's glad to be cooped up in this civil defense shelter with her. It's not necessarily one of those problematic episodes that we've talked in the past about how Sam is taking advantage of this person because she thinks that he's someone else. It's more a case of, like, you know, she doesn't really know Chick either, and so this whole build of the relationship is it's okay.
Yes.
But yeah, then he leaps out, and now he is a rabbi.
Oy vey. Oy vey. Yeah.
Which is indeed, let's face it, it's one of the cuter oh boys in the history of the show.
Mm-hmm.
That'll take us into the next episode, which will be Thou Shalt Not.
Thou Shalt Not.
Yeah. I wanted to go back. I know that this is a Quantum Leap podcast, and I certainly don't want us to get too overly political. Obviously, Dennis and I have feelings and points of view that maybe some of the listeners don't share, but I did want to take a moment to read something because I did find it. The summation that I was talking about that Alan Shore gives is wonderful, and I'm not going to read the whole thing, but he's gone on talking about free speech, and at one point he says that these really long speeches make me so tired sometimes, and one of the opposing attorney says, evidently it's speech time, and he replies, and speech in this country is free, you hack, free for me, free for you, free for Melissa Hughes to stand up to her government and say, stick it. And I object to the government abusing its power to squash the constitutional freedoms of its citizenry. And God forbid anybody challenge it. They're smeared as being a heretic. Melissa Hughes is an American. Melissa Hughes is an American. Melissa Hughes is an American. Last night I went to bed with a book. Not as much fun as a 29-year-old, but the book contained a speech by Adlai Stevenson. The year was 1952. He said, "The tragedy of our day is the climate of fear in which we live, and fear breeds repression. Too often, sinister threats to the Bill of Rights, to freedom of the mind, are concealed under the patriotic cloak of anti-communism. Today, it's the cloak of anti-terrorism." Stevenson also remarked, "It's far easier to fight for principles than to live up to them." I know we are all afraid, but the Bill of Rights, we have to live up to that. We simply must. And that was written, like, 12 years ago,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I think that words like that should be spoken and heard.
Mm.
And I couldn't agree more with its, you know, and I'm as guilty of this as anyone else, but it is easier to fight for these things than to live up to them sometimes.
Absolutely.
But we really should be living up to them. Even if that means sometimes you do something that you're not entirely comfortable with. Even if that means you have to maybe vote for someone that, you know, you might not be comfortable with, but you know isn't the other person, especially when that other person is just a terrible human being.
Absolutely.
So.
Send us your hate mail and messages. To @FitchWideWill. Instagram, Facebook.
Yeah. At Strummer _Fane is my Twitter. I don't mind. I'm always up for a conversation.
Because mm-hmm.
that's something else we've seemingly forgotten how to do, is have a conversation about it.
Absolutely.
It's just, you know, I'm right, you're wrong, and that makes me better than you. And I don't think that personally, but I feel like that's
absolutely
the tenor of a lot of the...
Actually, I think I'm right, you're wrong, that makes me better than you is 50% of the podcast landscape out there. I don't know.
It could be. But let's face it, 50% of the time, at least, we're wrong. So feel free to disagree with us.
Yes,
not only about our other viewpoints, but certainly about what we've had to say about Quantum Leap. So if you've got something to say, let us know. And if you want to come be on the show, let us know. But again, Happy New Year. I think we can both sum up our thoughts on Good Morning Peoria with... It's a damn good episode.
It's a great episode.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we're, like I said, we're kind of in the sweet spot now here of Quantum Leap. And yeah. I think we get a stretch of, like I said, 6 or 7 just really good episodes. And this is, you know, maybe these are the salad days of Quantum Leap, if you
yeah,
will.
There we go.
The classic, the golden age.
Excellent.
So thank you so much once again. We look forward to discussing Thou Shalt Not next time. But I think we're going to leap out of here. Dennis?
Leap out of here. Yeah.
Let's do it. All
yeah.
right.
Have a good week. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. If you enjoyed what you've heard or have any questions or comments, don't be shy. Reach out to us online at www.quantumleappod.com or Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook at Fates Wide Wheel. And remember to hit the subscribe button and leave us a review on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you may be listening. Until next time.
As I travel in space and time, I want to stay, I want to go. You see my face, but it's not mine. But you can't see, you'll never know. How can we